We made it. 200 episodes. Can you believe that? I want to thank you, the listener, whether you've been with us since the beginning or you just found us. It has been an incredible honor making content for you for the last 4 years. I want to thank the guests. I've learned more from you over the last 199 conversations than I have from school, books, other podcasts I listen to, and all the courses I've taken combined. I want to thank my team. Aaron, Lauren, Juan, Matt, Ashley, Kendra, Sam, Lucas, Ami, Maria, and everyone at Breakthrough Academy. Now, here is how today is going to work. I have selected 11 clips, 11 of the most complete, compelling, and succinct thoughts about business and about life from our incredible guests over the years. These are my favorites and the ones that I think are the most important or that have had the biggest impact on me that I want to share with you. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Now, I've sequenced them into an order that I think flows the best, and then I share some of my own thoughts in between. I really hope you enjoy this episode. I can't tell you how much blood, sweat, and tears have gone into making it. And let's get started with an incredible bit from episode 158, which was how to create a vivid vision for your company with Cameron Harold.
100 years ago, these three guys sitting out on the dirt in Barcelona, and they're making bricks. And they asked the first guy, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm making bricks." They said to the second guy, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm building a wall. I get to make the bricks to build this wall." They asked the third guy, "What are you doing?" He said, "We're building the cathedral called the Sagrada Familia. It's going to be the most incredible cathedral to worship God, and I get to make the bricks to build the left wall of the cathedral."
Right.
All three of them were doing the same job, but the one who saw the vivid vision, who understood the plans, saw value and meaning in their individual work as a part of the bigger picture. That's the power of the vivid vision concept and how it aligns people. The alignment power that happens from this is really incredible. I've also seen companies that have used their vivid vision to land bank financing because the bank finally understands what the business does. They never understood the business plans. They never understood the pitch deck. They never understood the spreadsheets. But they read this 4 or 5 page description of the company. They're like, "Oh, I get it." And they're excited to invest. The second thing is I've seen clients go out or companies go out and land multi-million dollar contracts from customers who were so excited about what the company was going to become versus what it is today. So I'm drinking a coffee right now, and the lid is by Solo Cups. So do you know who Solo makes the lids for coffee cups?
No,
I'm not drinking one right now. But they make them for Starbucks. Now, if Starbucks back in 1986. Went to Solo and said, "Hey, we want you to make cups for our little coffee chain," they would have said, "Yeah, we're not interested."
Right.
But if they sold them on the vision 3 years later for what Starbucks was going to become, and maybe their vivid vision also explained the BHAG and their corporate, they'd be like, "I'll bet on you today." That's the power. The vivid vision also gets employees to quit their jobs and come and work for companies. They'll quit their job and actually walk in a door for a company that isn't what they're going to become, but they're excited about getting to build towards that.
Okay, so let's maybe break this down a little. Like, what are the steps in that you recommend to writing one of these?
The first step is you've got to get out of the box. You can't sit in your office and craft a vivid vision.
Why?
You can't sit at, because you get stuck in planning. You get stuck in the how. Or you get dragged back into email, dragged back into Slack, dragged back into discussions. "Hey, do you have 2 minutes?" You need to go somewhere where you're inspired. Ideally, I tell people to go somewhere around nature. Go sit near the golf course. Go sit near the ocean or a lake or a river. Go up in the mountains. Go to a park. If it's the middle of winter, go sit in some fancy 5-star hotel in the lobby by the fireplace. Sit somewhere where you can relax and it's inspiring and you can allow your mind to dream. And then do not take an iPad or a MacBook or a phone with you. Take an old school notebook and a pen and start to mind map about different aspects of your business. So a mind map is just a series of sections that you're going to jot down ideas about as they come to you, right? So you'll open up a book, you'll write down marketing and you'll scribble down a couple ideas, and you'll think about sales, you'll scribble down a couple ideas. Oh, you got another marketing idea, you'll write it down. Think about operations, think about customer. You keep scribbling down all these ideas of what your company looks like 3 years from now. Almost again, as if you kind of hopped out of the time machine and you walked around, like, what would I describe my meetings to look like? How would my meetings be running? How would people be interacting at meetings? What tools are we using in meetings? You describe all of that, but then all of a sudden your brain goes, oh, marketing. We'll go write down a couple more marketing ideas. The key when you're doing this mind map is to spend a few hours doing it, right? If you want to smoke a doobie, smoke a doobie. If you want to put on some headphones and allow your mind to listen to some beautiful music as you're doing it, do that. Anything that gets your creatives to go. I usually inhale rosemary oil,
yeah,
which is an aromatherapy that allows you to open up your creative juices. In fact, that's how I met Simon Sinek, who wrote the book Start With Why. Simon read about me in 2003 using rosemary oil as a creative outlet or creative juice. So allow your mind to drift, write down all the ideas. And the key is don't worry about how it's going to happen. Mm. Right? When I was getting ready to build a home in Vancouver, I didn't worry about how they were going to do the electrical or how they were going to do the plumbing or how they were going to hang the cabinets. I described the home and I let the contractors and the teams that the contractor hired figure out how to make my vision come true. My job is to describe it in vivid detail so that others can figure out the how. So the entrepreneur is to figure out where we're going and describe it in enough rough points. After one or two sessions offsite, you should have enough to meet with someone like a Jennifer Houdet and her team at Conscious Copy to have them really craft out the beautiful vivid vision for you.
Okay, you guys know I have been a little hard on visionaries over the years. I will say things like, they're just ideas people and they play around with whiteboards and come up with, you know, fantastical strategies, and then they hand it off to their integrator and the integrator's team, and then they go and do all the work. And I stand by all that. I still think that's true. That does not mean vision isn't incredibly important. It is. I just don't think it's often talked about very well. It's not described in practical terms. And that's why I love this clip from Cam so much. We originally had him on the show to speak about another book, which was called Second in Command. And it's about how to install a COO. For those of you that don't know, Cameron Harold was the COO of 1-800-GOT-JUNK, and he helped build that business up with Brian Scudamore to be about a $100 million a year business. It's obviously grown since then, but he played a pivotal role early on. And so we had him on for the second in command thing, and then we had him on again for Vivid Vision. And I went and read Vivid Vision after the podcast interview that we did. And I said, there's really something here. There's something to this. And so I followed the steps, literally what he just said. Carved out some time. I got out of my hometown. I got away from business. And I sat down for a couple of days. And I wrote out my personal life, which is, you know, my spiritual life, my wife, who my marriage, which hasn't happened yet, but it will at some point, my health and fitness, my family, silly stuff like toys and material objects, like the cars I want and the motorcycles and the ridiculous fancy speakers that are going to be in the garage, where I can play like my silly music, my social circle. So like my friends and who we hang out with, travel and adventure, all sorts of stuff. And then on the business side, it's just exactly like he just described. It's like revenue, size, shape, scope, team, culture, systems, all that stuff. And I say all that to share this with you guys. Yes, this is an unbelievable tool for performance and getting your team on track and motivating people and channeling energy to the right things. But the thing that he doesn't say in that clip, and I wish he was standing next to me so I could ask him his take on this, because this has been my experience. It has been the most unbelievable cure-all for my mental health that I've ever found. Like when you're clear on what the point of all of this is, you can't believe the sense of calm and clarity and peace that kind of settles over you. And I know we all hear it's like, you know, you got to have your why, because you're going to go through these hard days and these hard seasons. And I've always found that to kind of sound a bit cliche sometimes. But it's true. And I just think a vivid vision or a painted picture is a much more detailed, much more descriptive version of your why. So my ask of you this year is do one for your personal life, do one for your business life, and then DM me on LinkedIn 12 months from now and tell me how different you feel. It's going to blow your mind. Okay, that is a perfect segue into this concept that I love, this next concept, which is called mission motivation. And this is from episode 125, which fire should I put out next with Mike Michalowicz. One of the subpoints is this idea of mission motivation. I'll just read it back to you. Are all employees, including leadership, motivated more by delivering on the mission than just by their individual roles? So the idea is there's an overarching narrative. There's a mission. There's an important objective for the business, not just doing X, Y, Z. And so my question for you is this: how can entrepreneurs in the blue collar space, which is where we live, how can they bring this idea to seemingly mundane tasks? Window cleaning, mowing lawns, building cabinets, whatever the case may be. How do you bring that down to the more mundane level?
Yeah. So what you do is you ask your customers you're already serving, why are you buying this and how are you benefiting? What's the joy you extract from this? No one cares about clean window, but people probably care about the view. No one cares about a mowed lawn, but they care that their kids are out there playing in the yard or whatever it may be. So find the true purchase. Then talk to your team and say, we don't mow lawns. We give people a safe place to enjoy play again outside or get away from the phones or whatever it is. And that becomes kind of this rally cry. Now, here's the thing. There's also what I call PIs or personal intentions. We have a corporate mission, clean, safe lawns, but we have all PIs. Maybe one of my employees wants to one day own their own home and doesn't have it yet. We have to be aware of that too. So set a corporate mission, but understand all of your colleagues' personal intentions. And I'm not going to buy your home for them. You're not going to do that. You may not be able to be in that position, nor should you gift that because there's no accomplishment. But you should make them constantly aware of it. That as we march toward our corporate mission, we have to march toward your personal mission. And that's where now you lock arms and you start moving forward.
Okay. First things first, making cabinets is not mundane. It's actually incredibly technical and very precise craftsmanship. I sounded like an absolute idiot there, which sometimes I put my foot in my mouth. But look, the reason I chose this clip is one of the things that makes me sad, and that is the right word for it, is when contractors talk about what they do in this sort of like downtrodden way, like it's just a painting company, or we're just plumbers. And I think sometimes it's like meant as humility, but sometimes it comes down as a lack of self-belief or self-esteem, and it bums me out. And I think where it comes from, we talked about this on the 7 Lies You Should Stop Telling Yourself episode, which came out on New Year's Day. If you haven't heard yet, you should check it out. Short. The post-secondary industrial complex has brainwashed the world into believing that people who work on laptops or spreadsheets or software are somehow more valuable than people who work outside or work with their hands. And I think we can all agree, and the data is coming back very clear on this, this is a lie. Now, this is an easy thing to point out, but it's a way trickier thing to solve. And the reason I love this clip from Mike is he gives us the answer. It's like, forget about the trade, the craft, the product, the service, whatever. Go a layer deeper. What pain are you relieving for your customer and society as a whole? Like, if you want salespeople who are confident enough to charge the prices you need to charge, if you want crew leaders who take so much pride in their work that they inspire energy and intensity on the job site, like if you want some freaking juice in your business, man, your people need to understand and connect with this mission motivation. And it's your job as a leader to connect the dots for them. Okay, shifting gears here, guys. Look, this is a hot take, but it's mine nonetheless. AI is the best thing that ever happened to trades and construction. Let's find out why with some ideas from Ken Rusk in episode 164. Is blue collar work making a comeback?
So we already know that 65% of blue collar workers are very happy in their life. And we know that 35% of white collar workers are happy in their life. Right there's an imbalance. And here's the reason why. when you work in a trade, for the most part, you have control. You have control over your input. You have control over your output and the quality of that output. You have control over the pace, the time, the schedule, your day. You usually have control over your financial gain if you know what you're doing. And that just isn't necessarily true, again, in the 15th floor of one of those cubicles. You're waiting for everybody else to react to who you are instead of you proacting to who you are. And I think that's the biggest difference. You can live a reactionary life climbing a corporate ladder, which for some is good because the security fits them. Or you can live proactively and get out into the world and say, I'm going to make my own life happen. I'm not going to wait for life to just happen to me. I'm going to happen to my life. Okay. You know, you hear about this if-then scenario. If I go to high school, if I get good grades, if I get a scholarship, if I get a college degree, and then if that college degree gives me a job, and then if that job pays me well, then, Benji, I can live my life. That's the complete opposite. You need to know what your then looks like now first, draw that out crystal clearly, and then find one of the many paths to go get it. Because at the end of the day, and this is where what I say is controversial sometimes, I don't care so much what you do for a living. I'm more concerned about what you do with what you do for a living. Mm-hmm. Because gaining the life that you want for yourself, that's the true win in the end.
So if you're looking for things that are quote unquote AI resilient or AI proof, or at least have a longer runway, this seems like a good one. And I wonder, I don't know if you thought about this, Ken, like, could you almost see a bit of a resurgence, a swinging of the pendulum back to blue collar and tradesy work as the information workers are getting displaced left, right, and center?
Well, I think any economy that tries to remain balanced will have that pendulum swing back and forth. There's no doubt, unless some of the forces are manipulative, and you know, again, I'm not anti-college. If you're going to operate on my shoulder so I can get back out on the golf course, I want you to know everything there is to know about a knife before you come at me with it. Okay, so trust me. Or if you're going to be an engineer that builds buildings, or you're going to be a teacher or whatever, yeah, that should be a pathway for you. But having said that, I do believe that we're in a place where these jobs are going to be resilient for a long time. I mean, you think about it. When you show up with a truck full of pine trees and a bunch of boulders and mulch and dirt in front of someone's house and you want to create a beautiful landscape, I just don't see a robot getting out of the truck and designing that and doing all that anytime soon. So, and making on the job, you know, changes or design changes or alterations. You know, what I see AI doing is what I just heard the other day. So you could be on the roof needing a piece of plywood that isn't 4x8, but let's say it's 3.5x6 because you need this piece. So you could just stare at that thing with these goggles. It will then transfer that information down to the guy on the ground who's cutting the plywood. And then he'll make that piece of plywood for you without you having to climb down or yell over the edge or have unnecessary steps in a dangerous situation. I see AI only enhancing these types of jobs, not replacing it. I mean, I don't know how happy you would be someone coming up trying to, you know, cut your hair as a robot or something like that. But I only see these types of technologies. You know, it's almost like swinging a hammer versus having one of those lightweight nail guns. I mean, I see that type of technology increasing, but not necessarily replacing.
This is so interesting. This interview is almost a year old now, and we have more data backing this up today than we did when we first interviewed Ken. So I'm more confident now than I was before. They say we are less than 5 years away from full-blown digital people. We're talking agentic AI that can open software, push buttons, take uber complex prompts, understand nuanced context, reason to a PhD level of research. It's crazy. However, we are minimum a full decade away from robotics that are good enough to do any kind of trade, and we're probably another 5 to 10 years away from combining the two, which is what's needed if you want to replace a red seal carpenter, right? Like, I'm no futurist, but you would need a super intelligent AI layer built on top of a super advanced robotics layer. And yeah, I know like there's like 3D printed homes and robot lawnmowers, but they suck. Everyone knows that. So here's where I'm going with all this. The future, certainly the medium term future of blue collar work, has literally never been brighter, guys. Put your kids in trades. Be ready to hire and train the onslaught of laptop people and information workers who are about to be laid off and will be looking for work for the next 10 years. We have a massive continent-wide housing shortage and are probably about to get the humans we've so desperately needed. This is like the plot twist, the ultimate plot twist that no one saw coming. And I'll tell you, I'm 100% here for it. Okay, John Warrilow was throwing some absolute heat on episode 114. And what he's talking about here is how to build a business of value. So this is a clip from 114, What's Your Business Really Worth with John Warrilow. Let's roll the clip. The first one is don't generalize, specialize. Why don't you just unpack the logic behind that rule first? And then I got a few follow-up questions.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you generalize every additional service you offer, you're making your business more dependent on you personally. Because if you think about to make a business work without you, you've got to train others to do the work. And it's a lot easier to train others to offer one service like Lee's done at One Day Flooring. Lee's really been disciplined about just doing flooring, and therefore he can bring on a crew. Doesn't take him 5 years of apprenticeship to train these young kids how to install concrete floors. Yet if he was tempted to sell other things, I mean, another one is Barry at 505 Junk up in Vancouver. So Barry, you know, has a crew that removes junk. So he's got trucks on the road, shows up at a homeowner, and he removes their truck. And you could say, well, what other synergies are there? So what else could I do if I was Barry? I've got guys on the road. I've got a truck. You know, I'm going to someone's home. There's a truck rule involved. Well, why don't I just cut their lawn at the same time? Because everybody needs lawn care services. But the moment you do that, yeah, you cross sell a second product. You make more revenue per visit, but you're now having to train and teach someone who's been trained at weighing junk to now, how do you deal with an electric lawnmower? How do you gas up a lawnmower? You have to teach them a second service. And then if you add a third or fourth or fifth service, it starts to become untenable. You start to get a business that's deeply dependent on you. So this idea of specialization is really akin to, you've got to get this kind of level one business to a point where you can get others doing the work. And the fastest way to do that is to specialize so that it takes you less time to train them.
You use the word discipline, which really jumped out to me. Can you just explain why it takes discipline for an entrepreneur to do that?
Yeah, because every client is going to want you to do other shit. Like they're all going to say,
right,
oh man, you know, you built my deck. You made it. It was so amazing. Do you guys ever consider doing fencing?
Right.
Right. And this is like lambs to the slaughter. I mean, you love the accolades from the client. Customer's happy. It makes you feel up warm and inside.
You like the revenue.
Gratified and you've done it. Yeah. Revenue, profit, you know, and you think, oh yeah, wait, I mean, we could do roofs. Why not? I know how to swing a hammer. It's tempting to do it because clients are asking you for it. Right. And that's the real challenge is that we've indoctrinated entrepreneurs to believe that, you know, you've got to listen to your clients. You've got to be client-centric. You got to be customer-centric. And while I agree to some extent, that's important. But, you know, Steve Jobs is famous for the quote, nobody ever thought they wanted 1,000 songs in their pocket, yet he created the iPod, the predecessor to the iPhone. He needed to have the vision to say, no, this is a product we can win. This is a product we can create, which will be better than anyone has ever imagined, but we have to be disciplined. And I think that discipline is, in some cases, flies in the face of what clients want you to do. Just because you're there with ladders to clean the windows doesn't mean you have to also do the eavesdrops. If you're not trained to do that, you don't have the insurance to do that, you don't have the people to do that. It's tempting because you're on the roof already, but you've got to stay within what you've trained your people to deliver.
Mm. The more time I spend with hyper-successful entrepreneurs, the more contractors I watch come through Breakthrough Academy and build eight-figure businesses and exit their companies for a pile of money, or in some cases they hold on to their businesses and just take a step back and enjoy the privileges and the luxury and the abundance of letting their leadership team run it, the more I watch these patterns unfold, the more true the saying, the riches are in niches, becomes. Narrow and deep is always better than wide and shallow. And here's a visual that comes to me when I think of this. Have you ever driven past one of those restaurants? They're usually in smaller towns, maybe in a strip mall somewhere. And there's like a sign out front and it's called like Piero's or whatever. And the sign says like pizza, pasta, Greek, Indian, Korean fusion. Oh, and we're known for like the best cheesecake in the country too. Have you ever eaten one of these places? The food is dog shit. I'm not actually kidding. It's horrific. What you want to be is the cafe that only makes amazing espresso and the best pastries in town. You want to be the restaurant who only does the most beautiful handmade pasta with fresh sauces. Get narrow with your offer, as narrow as the market you operate in will allow. The stuff you build will be cooler, your life will be easier, and in the end, guys, you'll make way more money. Just like John says, be disciplined. All right, for a laugh about how undisciplined some of our job sites have become, let's go to the great and powerful Paul Akers, the author of 2 Second Lean, one of my favorite books. This was episode 64, Thinking Lean, Eliminate Waste Through Continuous Improvement. Let's roll the clip.
How would you describe that 98%? What is the average state of the average job site in North America?
Well, train wreck, garage sale, non-thinking morons, it's insanity what people do. It's absolutely, I mean, there's nobody's thinking. And what most people are answering the question is that, well, it's difficult because we're contractors and we can't rely on the person before us and the person after us. So we've got to have everything staged there so all the doors get banged up, the windows get banged up, and 20% of them get replaced. And then I've got a full-time person just dealing with replacements and ordering replacements. And it's just like, has anybody ever stopped to think there's a way to fix this stuff? Here we go. Here's a stat that will just blow your mind beyond all comprehension. The average company in America, the well-run company, for every hour an employee works, they produce about $150 worth of product or output. Mm-hmm. Okay? Sales, you know, not profit, just output. We produce between $500 and $700 per man hour.
So five or six times industry average. And that's because there's more time on value-added work and less time on non-value-added work. Fundamentally, that's what it's about.
We're not walking around looking for stuff. Everything is so dialed in our place. It's so dialed in, and everything is continually improving all the time. And what that translates into a happier workplace.
What does that actually mean to you? You've said it a few times. We're continuously improvement. We are improving. We have a culture of continuous improvement. What does that philosophy mean? Can you unpack it a few layers just for someone that's listening to this for the first time? Like, what is continuous improvement?
It simply means the things that you go to do and you struggle with today, tomorrow, you're not going to struggle with. So for instance, we'll use the car keys. You struggle with looking for your car keys. So we would say, stop and fix what bugs you. Find a designated place that makes sense, put a hookup. And when you walk in your house, when you walk into your work, that's where the keys go. So that tomorrow, you will never be tortured again with the idea of looking where your keys are, because you know they're always going to be there. And if that improvement didn't work, you did the hook and it didn't work and you found out for some reason it really was not the strategic play, you then moved that hook or you changed that methodology until you found an environment that was repeatable and the process people liked because it produced a favorable result. So that's continuous improvement. Small incremental improvements to every process forever.
Okay, Paul does not mince words there, but he isn't wrong. right now, as we speak, hundreds, if not thousands, of smart contractors in every industry, in every market, are beginning to understand and implement what Paul and the entire lean community, for that matter, has been saying for over 20 years. Study lean manufacturing, learn the Toyota production system, understand the difference between value add and non-value add, identify the 8 kinds of waste in your business and eliminate them. Incorporating lean, and Paul said this really well, it's about a happy workplace, right? Incorporating lean should be less about making money, although that's virtually guaranteed, and more about creating a business people genuinely love to work inside of. The tools and the books, they're all out there. And look, it's way simpler to incorporate than even I expected. Plus, the philosophy is like super applicable to your personal and domestic life too. Once it sinks in, Paul Acker's famous tagline cannot be forgotten. Fix what bugs you. Okay, pulling on this thread a little more is Mark Bradley, the founder of LMN. But before he built LMN, he actually built the most efficient landscaping business in North America at the time, as measured by revenue per hour, which, as he's going to explain, is the easiest KPI to track and share to help operationalize the concept Paul Acres just talked about. So let's listen to Mark break this down a little bit. This is from episode 123, which we called Mark Bradley from Zero to 50 Million Plus Founding LMN.
Revenue per hour for me became a really important KPI in my business to assess whether or not every day, every week, every month was going well for a crew. So we had many different trades in my company. We had equipment operators and masons and carpenters, electricians, plumbers, landscape technicians, and more. And so every type of trade has slightly different revenue per hour. But for us, it was really important that everybody had a budget, every crew that is had a budget, and they understood how much revenue they should produce each day, each week, each month, and for the season or year. And so I really tied everything back to revenue per hour because it's easy to measure. Billing tells us what we're generating against the hours that we're paying out on payroll.
What did you find useful in communicating how important this was to the business, but then also kind of connecting it to them and their income and their growth as well? How do you get them bought into that whole idea of producing more quickly?
Yeah, I would say I struggled for many years with this and always struggled, and I think every business does. So I'll start by saying that. But what I found worked the best was creating a crew budget, which allowed the crew leader, whatever term you're using, a foreman, a crew boss, whatever that happens to be, but the leader of the crew that's performing the work out in the field, I always wanted to give them a budget that basically allowed them to see how many hours they were going to sell or perform or produce each year, whichever term you'd like to use. And so if that's a crew of three and they're working a full year, each person typically works about 2,000 hours a year. And so that would be a 6,000 hour crew. And then basically what that budget would do would allow them to understand how much revenue they should produce. And so we'd set the goal or the production goal for that crew. And if they hit the goal, they'd unlock a bonus. And if they exceeded the goal, then you'd put a gearing mechanism on that bonus. And so when you do that with a crew, they want to understand how to measure it. And so revenue per hour is the easy way to measure it. If it's a $1.2 million crew and they're going to work 6,000 hours, you can do the math and come up with an hourly or daily or weekly or monthly production goal.
The most important thing Mark just said, and he said it a couple times, I want to underscore this, easy to measure. Motivating people is really quite simple when they understand how the scoring works. That's why the M in SMART goals is measurable, and revenue per hour is a simple and easy one for everyone to wrap their heads around, so to speak. Now, Mark's entire business ethos, which I love, is centered around output per person, and it's baked right into the LMN software that he created, which is brilliant, by the way. If you're a landscaper, you haven't checked it out, you must. Okay, let's hear from one of my favorite guests, Tom Hughes, on how to use SOPs to support and drive revenue per hour. Because look, here's the thing. Confused people waste a lot of time. So this is episode 78, SOPs, why your business is a mess, and what to do about it with Tom Hughes. From Tom's perspective, what is an SOP and why do they matter?
Well, people do get really academic about what an SOP is. I prefer not to be academic. So my definition is a clearly documented and understood and agreed way of carrying out a task. It's that simple. But the three key terms are clearly documented, understood, and agreed. Because if those three things don't happen, you don't have an SOP that's of any use anyway. I would say that they're running in tribal knowledge is what we call it in lean circles. So
right.
You're running with what's in your head or your best people's heads. And that's a real problem when you're, you know, you want consistency of outcome. As we mentioned, everybody wants that in their business, whether you're a restaurateur or a contractor.
Let's dive into these three critical components, Tom. The three are, just to summarize, in your mind, number one is like the standard. Getting the standard right in the first place is harder than most people think. So that's sort of step one or component one. The second thing is making your SOPs easy to access. They need to be something that someone can engage with easily, not something that needs to be dug up from underneath a seat or gotten off a shelf, et cetera. And then the third one is there need to be easy to update. They're not these, you know, the only thing that is certain is that your business is going to change probably quicker than you can anticipate. Yeah. And so if you have this idea that you're going to write it once, like the Ten Commandments, and it's good forever, that is totally false. It's something that needs to be updated and changed and evolving with you and your company all the time. So let's dive into all three. Let's dive into all three of these. Let's start with the standard. What are some really common mistakes that you see made when trying to establish the right standards?
The first thing I would say is that standards are rare. So good standards, well implemented, are extremely rare. Most people don't see the value in them and they don't bother doing them. Mm. And two, traditional ways of doing them were expensive and time consuming. So people weren't willing to make the investment to get SOPs. So I would say that's the first thing. And GembaDocs solves a lot of the ease of use and resource issue. And that was the main reason we created it. We'll get to that in more detail later. But simply put, instead of like a bottleneck engineer or a high manager type person going around documenting other people's standards and taking photographs and emailing them to himself and putting them in PowerPoint or Word or whatever and taking forever, mm-hmm. GembaDocs, get your phone out, take a picture, document each step. It literally takes a few minutes and anybody can do it. The second problem would be ownership of the SOPs. So generally, you got the people doing the work aren't involved to any great extent in how the work's documented. At a very basic level, I learned back then that if the guys doing the job don't feel some ownership, forget it. They literally utter wallpaper.
That's a very, very relatable situation, Tom, because I think a lot of business owners listening will have tried to build an SOP at some point or many points, and they spent a weekend, they locked themselves in the office, they strapped themselves to the computer and wrote up some very detailed multi-page standard operating procedure for how to do some core process in their business. And then on Monday, they come back to the office all excited like a kid doing show and tell, and they show the team, and guess what? No one gives a shit and doesn't get followed whatsoever because they didn't have any involvement in 100%. The build. Let's move on. 100%. The second thing that you think is really important is these things need to be easy to access.
The first one I touched on earlier is put the answer where the question is. So if I have to go running around trying to find where is that process, and in manufacturing the typical example is it's in a folder in a cupboard somewhere and nobody really knows where it is. And it's a monument that was built once and nobody looks at it again. The big problem with the monument and why the guys don't even bother to go and look in the folder under the seat is because they're out of date anyway. So nobody bothers.
Let's recap some of the stuff we've talked about. You need to get the standard right in the first place. And word of caution, you as the owner are probably not the right person to do that. You're going to need the help of your team. Number two is make sure they're easy to access. Yeah. Set them up at point of use. You said this so well. Put the answer where the question is, right? Not in some cupboard like many, many steps away, a five-minute walk away from the work, from where the work is happening. Not in a remote office away from the job site. Put the answer where the question is. And then the last thing is they need to be very, very easy to update because your business and your processes are always changing. Okay, I'll be the first to admit, never in a million years did I think that standard operating procedures would be such a hot topic. But this episode absolutely crushed it when it came out. And it's not just because Tom has a fabulous Irish accent either. We reproduce the same result when we turn this into a web class 6 months later. The internet has spoken. Contractors want to learn about standard operating procedures. And that's a great sign. Because listen, growing your business without SOPs is a little like eating light bulbs. Really, really painful at the beginning and then more painful later on, right? Get the standard right by working with your team. They know better than you. Make them easy to access. Put the answer where the question is and make them easy to update because surprise, surprise, your business is always changing. By the way, Tom's SOP building software, Gemba Docs, is 1,000% worth doing a free trial on. I'm not paid to say this. I just believe in what he's building. We have a bunch of listeners already using it who swear by it as well. Okay, let's move on. Dan Martella is up next. This was a huge guest for us. Let's hear what he has to say in episode 144, How to Buy Back Your Time with Dan Martell.
You don't hire people to grow your business. You hire people to buy back your time. It's a calendar over capacity problem. Because if you do the first, hire people to grow your business, you don't get the second. And if you do the second, you get the first.
How so? And how are those two things different?
They're completely different. If I run a logo design company, I'm going to hire another logo designer. What you should do is look at your calendar and say, what am I doing that is not logo design?
Right.
And have people support you on everything else that's not logo design because that is your core business.
Right.
So when I think of a home builder, and trust me, I loved work. My brother, he was my business partner. I didn't tell him many people, but I was his business partner. So we would meet daily about this stuff. So we had to create all these systems to make sure he was focused on the business of building homes, not getting pulled into being a firefighter. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what does that mean? It means first off, Pierre, you need an executive assistant. Do you realize how hard he pushed? Dude, he pushed on me so hard. I don't need an executive assistant. I need somebody that's a site supervisor. I said, no, you don't. You're the site supervisor, ding dong. Mm. You know how to do this. You manage it. Have somebody else go run around, pick up stuff for you. Why are you spending two or three days a week, running errands, buying stuff, purchasing things, like just the weirdest things they would do. When you actually audit your calendar, okay, for time and energy, you'd find the weirdest thing that people accept themselves to do. Taking photos on sites, it's like, dude, you don't need to do any of that. You need to go make sure the trades are lined up, the work's being done right, and then all the social media stuff, all the purchasing stuff, all the invoices. We created this crazy cool system where it was like a color coding timestamp process where we knew based on what the average phases of a home build is, right? Then we broke it down into seven. How much money should we have been invoiced by our trades to have a red, green, yellow if the construction draws and you know, all this, like, dude, I had to learn about construction. I didn't want to learn it, but I'm just a systems guy. So that part is where people don't get it, is they shouldn't hire folks to do more of the work. First, they should buy back their time because they're the experts.
Right.
And only once you've filled up that capacity in regards to administrative, even hiring a runner. I mean, literally, some of these people should just hire somebody that goes out around the sites all day, ask people what they need, go make the purchases so that the people that need to be on site doing the work stay on site and do the work. And then you work your way backwards, but it's always through the lens of your calendar. So that's the buyback principle.
So, but this is a really important distinction because a lot of people would sort of listen to podcasts, read books, go to conferences, and they'd get all this messaging about who they ought to hire next. So you want to grow, you need to hire a marketing person, you need to hire a salesperson, you need to hire an estimator, you need to hire a project manager. And it's not to say that all that is wrong necessarily, but they're thinking about it in terms of nodes on the system that is their org chart. I got to go plus, plus, plus. Not wrong, but what you're saying is forget about that. Just literally look at the calendar and see where the lowest leverage crap is and then just pay someone to do that and sort of like rinse and repeat until...
It's literally the buyback loop, right? The buyback loop states we should do a time and energy audit. So step one is audit.
What is that?
So the buyback loop is essentially what you do when you feel pain. So most entrepreneurs get to a point where they're actually successful, but they feel the pain. And what I've learned a long time ago is entrepreneurs will not grow into pain. So the mission I'm on is to help entrepreneurs build businesses they don't grow to hate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the people that shut down, it's not because the market wasn't there, is they built their business in a way they didn't know any better and they decide, I'm gonna shut it down. This hurts, I don't wanna do this anymore. So what the buyback loop is essentially the antidote to that. And once you feel the pain line, then you go through this three-step process and that's how you spin forward, okay? Mm-hmm. So the first step is audit. We have to look at our calendar and audit it for the last 2 weeks on time and energy. The second step is transfer. Take everything that's low cost to pay somebody to do that you hate doing, and you give that to somebody else. You transfer it to them, okay? So most people that are starting businesses don't know how to delegate. Mm-hmm. Benji, they literally don't know how to teach somebody how to do something. So let's start with some low stake stuff. Right. Do I want to delegate somebody managing a home build for me as my first hire? Or do I want to hire somebody that can manage running
an inbox.
Errands? Inbox.
Yeah.
Purchasing stuff on the internet for me. Let's start low stakes. And then the third part of the buyback loop is fill. Is once I get this time back, what do I then reinvest it in? Because some people waste it. They buy back the time and then they just
do nothing.
Oh my gosh, it's wasteful. I honestly it gets to me because I'm like, look, your job is to create an empire, and an empire is a life of unlimited creation you never have to retire from. That's why we start businesses, is to have the financial freedom for our families. So if you get an hour back, 2 hours back, 3 hours back a day, mm-hmm. you should know exactly what you're going to do with those 3 hours to become a better version of you so that you can grow the business.
You don't hire people to grow your business. You hire people to buy back your time. I think I finally understand why this philosophy is so profound and has helped so many people. It took me a while. This is a really meta point. You have to play around with it, experiment with it, but I think I finally get it. When you hire people to grow your business, so to speak, whether you realize it or not, you put yourself in this precarious situation where you have to hire people into roles and into functions that you yourself don't fully understand yet. Like if you picture an org chart, what you're doing is I said this in that clip, you're adding nodes around you, not behind you. It's like, what does a carpenter turned construction business owner actually know about digital marketing before they hire a digital marketing person? I'm gonna tell you, in 99 cases out of 100, not very much. What does a pool guy turned landscape business owner actually know about hiring a sales manager? In 99 cases out of 100, not very much. What happens when you hire to grow your business is you add functions that you don't have a baseline understanding of. And you will have no doubt been here before, as I have, by the way, right? It's like new marketing person is telling you about CPMs and CTRs and ROAS and customer acquisition cost and content factories, and we need to install a listening mechanism. And you nod along pretending to know what they're talking about because you're the owner, and now it's too late to admit that you're a little bit lost, and that's embarrassing. Right? And this is how you end up, by the way, overstaffed, super bloated, frustrated, and then bankrupt. Listen to this. When you take the hire people to buy back your time approach, though, you're not hiring around you anymore. You're hiring behind you, behind the path that you are carving. And I don't mean behind in some hierarchical kind of way. It's just an easy way to think about this concept. It's like, hey, I have spent a year plus figuring out the basics of digital marketing. I get the gist of it, but I'm not amazing at it. And I no longer have the capacity to do this stuff anymore. And there are bigger fish to fry for me, the owner. And so I need someone else to do this. Hiring people to buy back your time is a forcing function for leading from the front. You're betting on yourself as the best person to solve the most complex problems, or at least take a first crack at them. And then anything that gets in the way of that, you hire out. And that's the part I want to highlight. It's really quite elegant when you think about it. You're the engine that grows the business and no one else. You don't hire people to grow your business. You hire people to buy back your time. Okay, speaking of hiring, let's get some insights from one of my favorite guests and an amazing partner of ours, Matt Reisinger. This is from episode 182, Matt Reisinger's Secrets to Team Building. Let's roll the clip.
You know, one of the abilities I'm looking for, or probably the biggest ability I'm looking for, is problem analysis and judgment, often referred to as critical and logical thinking. I want people that are really good at thinking critically and logically. You know, as a custom builder, everything that I build has never been built before. As a production builder, you're following a recipe and you're making a McDonald's hamburger. But as a custom builder, if you don't have good critical and logical thinking, if you don't have good problem analysis and can make good judgments on the job, you're not going to be successful in that job for me. So that's the ability I'm looking for. And then the work behaviors are what feeds that that kind of engine, so to speak. That's the gasoline that goes into the engine. So when I'm looking for people in whatever job, I'm looking to see, okay, I need a high horsepower engine here. Let's dig into what they've done in the past and let's find out about their judgment and their ability to think critically. So those are, that means I'm going to ask them questions that say, okay, tell me about a time when you had way too much work to do and you had to figure out how to get it all done. Tell me about the situation that you were under. Why was that an issue that you were overworked or you were whatever? Tell me about the actions you took and what was the result. So as a student, that might be, you know, I had this many class loads. I had this big class load and I was working part-time, full-time. As a adult that you're interviewing, that's, you know, I had this one time where I had five houses under construction at the same time. And you're probing them to find out, you know, was it you had five houses under construction one time because you were too late on the last three and they took 18 months to build when they should have taken 12 months? Or, you know, what was the situation even that got them into that? And then how did they get out of it? Did they get out of it by hiring someone? Maybe that's a good answer. Maybe not. You got to figure that out. But what you're looking to do is say, okay, are these people, is this person in front of me able to use really good critical and logical thinking skills? And we can all think of people that don't have good critical and logical thinking skills, and they're probably only good at one or two different specific types of jobs. They're probably not real good at being a project manager.
I have on this critical thinking slash problem solving bit, I have a personal core value, and the people that work with me closely know this. It's called use your brain. And I have like less than zero patience for non-critical thinkers because there's too, yeah. There's too much going on. Like I can't like figure it out. Like that is truly my answer to a lot of things. You're smart. You have That's this right. incredible, you know, however many billions of synapses up there and all this gray matter and this oxygen flowing to it, it's sitting there. Use it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, yes. then this isn't going to work for very long. Because I've got, you know, we everyone on our team, and this is true of any sort of really business at any level, we all have our own list of problems that we're trying to work through. And yes, there's coaching and there's collaboration and we're there to support each other for sure. But if all you're getting is a steady stream of, I don't know how, can you help me? What should I do here? Type questions. Not only are your projects going to go sideways, you're going to be absolutely freaking exhausted. Critical thinking and horsepower. Those are the two themes of that clip. If I had to distill team building down to first principles, or if I had to choose only two traits to bet on, critical thinking and horsepower are what I'm going with every time. Now, Matt makes this point from the custom home builder's lens, but this concept is not unique to his industry. And look, critical thinking, it's in decline. Dopamine addiction, social media, and now more recently AI are sadly going to rot a lot of people's brains. That's a fact. Horsepower isn't doing great either. 80 years of post-World War II abundance here in the West have made a lot of us and a lot of our kids soft. But not all of us. But not all of us. Believe that there are still smart and hardworking people out there for your business, because there are. I really have nothing else to add to this other than to say, please, please, please become a fan and a follower of Matt Reisinger, even if you're not in construction. What this man is doing for the performance building community right now is awe-inspiring. He is literally building a Netflix for construction nerds. And I think it's one of the coolest plays being made in this space right now. Study the way he makes content. Look at the way he's starting a movement. If I could buy stock in buildshownetwork.com right now, I would. He is helping so, so, so many people build better homes. And personally, I just love the guy. He's the real deal. Okay, one of our bigger guests this year was Chris Voss, the author of Never Split the Difference. Shout out to our amazing producer, Lauren Frost, for landing him. He made some incredible points about tactical empathy in episode 179, Negotiation Tactics for Contractors. Let's roll the clip.
Empathy has become synonymous with sympathy. Mm. And it was not originally designed and intended that way. Empathy is strictly understanding where the other side's coming from. It's not agreeing, it's not disagreeing. You know, the reason that I first started collaborating with the Harvard guys, because Bob Mnookin, the head of the program on negotiation, wrote a book called Beyond Winning. And I think it's the second chapter in the book. It's the best chapter on empathy I've ever read. Even, you know, it's better than what's in Never Split the Difference. When people come on to my team, I have them read this chapter and I quiz them on it to make sure that they understand it. And the reason I collaborated with Harvard and Professor Mnookin from the beginning, because he said empathy is not about agreeing with the other side. It's not even liking him. Empathy is just understanding where they're coming from. Right. And so if you can define it that narrowly, someone from Hamas can use empathy with someone from Israel.
Right.
And vice versa. It's stating with the other side's understanding where the other side's coming from, not agreeing with it, not even liking it. Now, the important next step to make it tactical is you got to utter it. You got to say it out loud. And that's what really scares a lot of people. They think empathy is, all right, if I understand where you're coming from, I can make a better argument.
Mm.
Well, you left out the middle part, the demonstration of understanding. Nobody ever felt heard. If you make a better argument, if you say, this is what you believe, you think this. When I was working terrorism in New York City in a joint terrorist task force, I talked to a Muslim who was a legit Muslim. I mean, they believed in a religion. They followed the practices in the United States because they're sending money back to their family someplace in the Middle East. You know, they're not radicals. You know, they're just genuinely following the religion. And I'd say to them, you believe that there's been a succession of American governments for the past 200 years that's been anti-Islamic. Mm. And they go, yeah, yeah, that's right. Now, I never said it was true. I said, you believe.
Right.
And I also never followed up with, but that's not true because we got a First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of religion, you know, all the explanation.
Right.
Just articulating what their perspective is the tactical aspect of it. And, you know, I never said I agreed.
Yeah.
I started out with you believe.
There's something about empathy. I like how you said people are mixing it up with sympathy. There's something about empathy as a fundamental idea that is somewhat emotionless. It's much more cerebral. It's much more like mental. It's like I can put myself cognitively, visually in your shoes so that I understand the framing, the perspective, the lens that you're looking through. But I'm not like, I'm not animated. I'm not upset. I'm not excited. I'm just, it's a very like cerebral exercise of going there. And that's a very, I think, an important distinction. It's obviously helpful to sympathize with someone or you know, feel their pain to some extent. But this is, I think, what you mean when you say in the book, like, I think you frame it like, don't feel their pain, label it. That's a distinction.
Yeah, very, very well said. It's really analytical.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Sam Harris might have been in an interview with Lex Fridman. I think he said empathy is a species of reason.
Right.
And I thought, ooh.
That's catchy.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It is highly analytical. You got to think. Empathy requires thinking.
So where does it fit in and really offer us utility in a negotiation, this tactical empathy idea?
Well, at all indicators. Like even if I'm engaged in harm bargaining, I'm going to use a lot of empathy with you because you're taking positions based on last century Newtonian thinking. You know, what's Newtonian thinking? It's the way we thought about physics before Einstein came around and told us that everything was wrong.
Right.
So empathy gets people out of that thinking. It increases trust. I mean, it's the application of it is universal, and I'm using it all the time. I'm using it before I make a hard ask. I'm using it as a response to your hard ask. I'm using it to clear your head. I'm using it to demonstrate that I want to collaborate with you over a long-term time frame because we'll both make more money if we do.
Empathy lubricates interactions. Like, you want your pitch to be more persuasive? Spend the 30 minutes before listening closely, labeling their pain, relating to it. You want your team to follow your lead? Spend more time in your one-on-ones listening to the challenges they're facing at work and make sure that they know that you know what they're going through. Learning to empathize with people is the most cost-effective way to level up almost every skill in your business tool belt. And Chris Voss describes it better than anyone I've ever heard. Okay, so look, let's close this out with some thoughts on branding. Dan Antonelli has built some iconic brands in the trades and construction space. This amazing section is from episode 106, Is Wrapping Your Vehicles Worth It? With Dan Antonelli.
I sort of talk about in the book the idea that the most expensive logo you'll ever buy is one you paid the least amount for. And that sounds sort of weird, right? But that's because all your other marketing is now not going to work as well as it could because you're working to overcome the inherent flaws in the foundation of your branding, right? So we talk about the wheel model, right? So in the center of that wheel, your marketing wheel is your logo. And then the spokes are all the things integrating that logo, your social, your web, your uniforms, your truck wraps, like all those things. And yes, you can spin that wheel if that hub isn't perfectly round, but it's going to take a hell of a lot more effort. And that just translates into a hell of a lot more money. So you can market the hell out of a really poor brand and get it to work. But the idea is I want our clients to be spending the least amount of money possible on their marketing. And the way to do that is to have a more effective brand. You know, so Roy Williams is a great, really smart guy in the advertising world. I think the quote I have from him in the book is overspending on marketing is the tax one pays for being unremarkable, right? So just, again, just thinking about it from that perspective. And there's hundreds of really, really large companies that are overspending on their marketing because they have an unremarkable brand, right? So again, if you're a little guy in a market with big fish, how do you do something that is more remarkable and that will become more sticky than these guys that all they're doing is just banging money at a crap brand, right? And they're getting by and they're doing okay. But when you hear guys talking, hey, we're spending 10, 12%, or you need to spend 10 or 12% if you want to grow, like, I'm sorry, but I call bull on that. Right. You know, because you don't need to spend that much more money if you have a better brand. Like I have guys that have gone from 2.5 to 16 million in 4.5 years on a 4% spend. So you want to tell me how the hell did they do that in a really, really competitive market when everyone else is saying, oh, you got to spend 10%, you got to spend 12%. Well, yeah, I know why you're spending 12% because your brand is crappy.
When you look at what you will spend on marketing over the next 10 years as you grow your business, add it all up. Web design, ad spend, swag, print materials, sales collateral, video content, SEO, PPC, social media, vehicle wraps, everything. And you add it all up. It's a big number. Now, do you want to spend all those dollars amplifying crap? No, you don't. Think about it like this. Like, you wouldn't spend $5,000 on a new home stereo system that has beautiful sound and beautiful EQ and can play really loud. You wouldn't spend that money if all you had to play was a white noise machine, would you? But that's what most home services, your competition, by the way, are doing right now and will for a while yet. So the reason I chose that clip and the point I'm kind of closing on here is the competitive advantage available to you when it comes to brand is so insanely big, it's hard to quantify, although he basically just did. People gawk at the cost of a good brand package, but then turn around and light the same amount of money or more on fire on digital marketing or ads or web design or you name it, whatever marketing tactic that doesn't work. Don't build your house on sand. Don't build your empire on a bad brand. Listen, that's all the time we got. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I had a ton of fun reliving those moments. It was really humbling to watch them all. It's been an absolute honor serving you guys. I have profound gratitude for the opportunity to have done so. As you continue to ascend into your own greatness, which you're doing an amazing job of, by the way, don't get complacent, greedy, or ungrateful. And always try to make places better than you found them. Benji signing off.